Today is May 8th, and it is the 80th anniversary of the end of the war in Europe. And by a total coincidence, that date, May 8, 1945, plays an important role in my talk today. So this was not planned, but I just realized that yesterday when I saw talks about the commemorations. So what I want to talk to you about today is to speak to the way we can manage the unruly plurality of law. And it's sometimes said that war zones are lawless, but that is actually rarely the case. And more frequent is a reality that war zones suffer from too much law rather than not enough law. And I'm going to explain what I mean by this possibly surprising assertion over the course of my remarks today. This is a paper that is posted on SSRN. If you're curious, it's not yet published. It will be published in an edited volume on international legal theories and war, hopefully at some point later this year. And I want to start with a series of strange stories. And I'm thinking that if you remember only the stories that I'm telling from today's talk, that would be actually a good thing, because these are amazing stories that should be remembered. And these are stories that have been very rarely or little studied. And when they have been studied, they haven't been studied by people who aren't lawyers. So there's very little legal research about the kind of phenomena that I will speak to. And I'm taking a first step to analyze these strange situations. So let me start with a first story, which is the outrageous and tragic story of Rainer Beck and Bruno Dörfer. And I'm going to speak mostly to Rainer Beck because I couldn't really find too much information about Bruno Dörfer. So Rainer was born in Germany in 1917. His mother was Jewish and his father not Jewish. And because of his mother, he was expelled from public school at age 16. And eventually, in 1936, became a harpooner on a whaling ship in the Pacific. And that's where he was when eventually war broke up in Europe and all German flagged ships were ordered to return to Germany, which is how Rainer found himself back in Germany. And then shortly thereafter, all ships were incorporated into the Kriegsmarine, the German military navy. And so Rainer, although half Jewish, became a soldier of the Third Reich, despite his intense hatred of the Nazi regime for obvious reasons. So he managed to make it through most of the war undiscovered. And had he been discovered, he would have been a candidate for deportation to an extermination camp. But he always was very much afraid that he might be discovered. And so when he was based in Amsterdam in 1944, in the fall of 1944, after the landing in Normandy and the slow progress of Allied troops through to liberate Europe, he finally deserted and hid in Amsterdam for several months. And after the Canadian Army liberated Amsterdam, for reasons that we do not know, he surrendered himself in the company of Bruno Dörfer, who also was a deserter from the Kriegsmarine, to the Canadian military. It's possible that he feared being attacked by civilians because there were a lot of attacks against Germans or anybody connected. So that might be an explanation, but we do not know. The Canadians didn't know what to do with these two Germans. And the German forces in Germany, in the Netherlands, had surrendered to the Canadians a few days earlier and had essentially marched themselves into a detention camp where they gave up most, but not all, of their weapons. The officers kept their sidearms, interestingly. And so the Canadians simply put these two deserters, Rainer and Bruno, with the other Germans. And the other Germans were very much not happy at having two deserters amongst them. And the German commander told the Canadian commander that, you know, they had to get them out, or he was going to prosecute them for desertion. And the Canadian commander wasn't bothered. And so the Germans convened a martial court on which sat German military judges, which had been interned with the other Germans, and did prosecute before the assembled camp these two individuals, Rainer and Bruno, for desertion in the field. And unsurprisingly, they were found guilty. And again, unsurprisingly, punishment for desertion on the field of battle under the German military code was death. So the next day, the German commander went back to the Canadian commander and he said, all right, now we've had our trial and they were convicted, sentenced to death. So now we need 8 guns and 16 bullets to carry out the execution. And the commander, the Canadian officer, was taken aback because, you know, there was peace in the Netherlands. And in fact, by that point, the German forces in Europe had surrendered. This was actually by that point after it was May 12th. So a peace had been signed. But as a good soldier, he asked for higher ups in HQ what he should do. And the contrast is not great. This is a telegraph that relates from a declassified file that I obtained from my new friends at the Historical Service of the Canadian National Defense Department. And it says, on 13th of May, some German Marines deserters were tried, convicted, and sentenced to be shot by a German court-martial. Canadian military on spot asked Canadian Division Headquarters if executions could be carried out. Canadian HQ informed Chief of Staff of German 30th Corps and requested his decision. The Chief of Staff, this is the German, General Blaskowitz, thanked the Canadians HQ for advising him. He approved sentence saying he would advise the German command in Amsterdam. So essentially, the Canadians deferred to the Germans who had surrendered by that point, and the Germans approved the execution. And so it was that on May 13th at 5:30 in the afternoon, Einerbeck and Bruno Dörfers were executed 5 days after war had ended in Europe. Now, I learned this story about a year ago, and I thought this was crazy. That this was, it didn't make any sense that this would happen. Because, you know, it begs the question of what is the law governing these people in this camp in the Netherlands? Is it Canadian law? Is it German law? Is it Dutch law? You know, territoriality typically for us lawyers is a pretty determining aspect of things. Who has jurisdiction? Do we ask questions about the fairness of the trial? Or is this, you know, immaterial? Was this a war crime committed by the German commander, by the German judges, by the German firing squad? a war crime by the Canadian who authorized such a crime. It's not clear. What is known is that no one was ever charged or prosecuted for these events. So it leaves us in a state of uncertainty or indecision as to what the legal optics should be on such strange events. Now turn to a second story, which is a little bit similar and a little bit different. And that story takes place in Medicine Hat, Alberta. Medicine Hat was one of the places where a prisoner of war camp was built to accommodate German POWs that were taken prisoners in Europe and were shipped out of Europe to North America, both the United States and to Canada, for safekeeping because it was simpler than in a war zone. And two soldiers, Carl Lehmann and August Plasek, whose photo you see here, were both captured in North Africa. They were members of the Afrika Korps under General Rommel when they were captured, and eventually sent to camp number 132. On Lehmann's photo, you can just about read in the placard, camp 132, showing that photo was taken at the camp in Medicine Hat. There were 12,000 men, POWs, in that camp, so it was a very large camp. And in 1943 and 1944, both men were found dead in the camp, having been killed. And there was an investigation, and it took a long time to find information. And eventually, somebody left an anonymous note explaining what had happened and naming the individual who had killed both Lehmann and Plasek. And the story was that, seven men were arrested and charged with murder and prosecuted before the Alberta Supreme Court, the trial division for criminal law in Alberta at the time. So the defense argued that these two men, Lehmann and Plasek, had been communist agitators and that they had been traitors to the Third Reich and that a court had been convened inside the camp and that they had been found guilty and that, you know, again, the sentence for treason was death and they were executed pursuant to a specific provision of the German Code of Military Justice. The defense, and I went through the transcripts of the trial, which were in the National Archives in Ottawa, and the defense pleaded in part, and I quote, "So anything that had been done in the camp had been performed in essence in Germany, and the case should be tried in that country and not in Canada." So they're arguing essentially that a POW camp is a little bit like a bubble, kind of extra-jurisdictional bubble inside the detaining country. The defense also raised the fact that on an ongoing basis, the German leadership in the camp prosecuted POWs who were caught engaged in homosexual acts, as this was a violation of German law, German military law. And so they were prosecuted and sanctioned with a stripping of grades and a beating. And that all of this was done with the knowledge of the Canadian authorities and that the Canadian authorities did not have any issue with that application of German law inside the camp. And so the defense argued that, you know, the Canadian state already acknowledges that German law applies and can be applied, and that there is some kind of jurisdiction inside the camp. I note in passing that homosexual relations were also a criminal act under Canadian law at the time. Perhaps unsurprisingly, all these defenses were rejected by the Alberta Supreme Court. The seven men were found guilty of murder, and they were all hanged in 1946 in Ontario, in Canada. So two stories, but they quite similar, but they play out differently. A story in Amsterdam that speaks to a measure of conviviality between the two legal orders at play, perhaps intermingling, in a POW camp. And a story in Medicine Hat where there is a claim of hierarchy that seeks to impose a single legal order and invalidate entirely the other legal order. All of which, of course, you know, under the same general law, and in both cases it was Canadian law, German law, international law. Because I, you know, the Dutch law that I mentioned in passing actually has no role to play in this story. So this begs the question of whether the Canadians could actually decide to defer to a German court. I mean, is that something that they could simply choose to do and essentially wash their hands of it, which is more or less what they did in Amsterdam. And there is a, in the record, there is a mention that when the Canadian officer asked Canadian HQ in Amsterdam for directions, the answer came back that if some Germans want to kill some other Germans, you know, why should I be bothered? And so, you know, washing their hands of it. And likewise, the sanction for homosexuality, you know, in Medicine Hat seems to have been handed over willingly and knowingly by Canadian authority. So another example that is perhaps even more explicit that I came across, another thing that I didn't know anything about until a few months ago, is the fact that the Americans at the end of the war created a POW camp for child soldiers, which is, I've written quite a bit about child soldiers. I've never seen any mention of this anywhere. But I came across it kind of by coincidence. And the Americans created this camp in Attichy, which is about 100 kilometers northeast of Paris, in a kind of a remote area, where they sent all these underage, under 18 German soldiers, who essentially were Hitler youth, who had at the very end of the war, the Germans were desperate for soldiers, and the Hitlerjugend were shifted to the active military, despite the fact that they were very young, most of them to the Luftwaffe in the anti-aircraft batteries. But they were soldiers, and so they were POWs. And they were put in this camp, 15,000 of them, so a significant number. And in that camp, amazingly enough, I discovered there was created a youth court that the child soldiers ran themselves. And the children were the judges and the prosecutors and the defense attorneys to prosecute other children committing violations. Oh, no, I know. It's kind of stretches credibility, but there we go. It's, you know, I even have a photo to show that it happened. And indeed, so there was a story from Life magazine
Please explain the Dutch soldier issue a little bit more. It's not clear to me.
Yeah.
What is meant by Dutch soldiers?
Dutch soldiers are individuals who are not yet 18 years old who take part in active hostilities, right? And so in this case, they were formerly members of the armed forces of a state. And so they were child soldiers in the fullest sense possible. So they actually took part in fighting. I mean, some of them never fired anything, but they were soldiers. So there was a reporter from Life magazine who actually happened to come by. And so that's in part why we know about this camp. And so this is a photo from Life magazine, and you can't read, but the quotation here says, defense attorney Eric Heinz, left 17, asked clemency on the ground of Nazi moral degeneration, home upbringing, and that the stolen sweater was dirty anyway. Is that Jewish chairman dirty on the wash line? Who ate the accused sitting? But full sentence demanded. And so it's quite interesting. I mean, it's these are small things about, you know, getting into fights and in this case stealing a sweater. What it points to is the fact that this was done with the knowledge and one imagines supervision of the American authorities in the camp. And in a way, it is an answer to the question I was asking, a factual answer anyway, which is that the Americans seem to have been happy to delegate to the children, law and order inside the camp to some extent. Now, obviously, when you're confronted with puzzling things, as a lawyer, you know, we look for a rule that will, you know, give us the answer, basically. So the rule here that we might turn to is, at the time, Article 45 of the 1929 Geneva Convention on Prisoners of War, which is reproduced verbatim in the current Third Geneva Convention in Article 82. Prisoners of war shall be subject to the laws, regulation, and orders in force in the armed forces of the detaining power. So what it does clarify is that the laws of Canada and the United States applied to the German POW. So the Germans were not immune from the jurisdiction and laws of the detaining state, which does not come as a surprise, and which we would have expected. What Article 45, or currently 82, paragraph 1, does not say is that the laws of the country to whose armed forces the soldiers, the POWs, belong does not apply. And that, of course, is not an accident, right? And indeed, there is a consensus, if not unanimity, among states that, and I quote here from the 2020 ICRC commentary to Article 82 of the current convention, captivity does not sever the bond of allegiance between prisoners of war and the state on which they depend as members of the armed forces. Nor does Article 82.1 suspend application of the domestic law of the country of origins of the prisoners of war. So, for example, the UK military manual and the US military manual both say that American or British soldiers, if they are captured and held as POWs, remain subject to the US Code of Military Justice or the UK equivalent. So in a way, you know, the countries sort of agree with the Amsterdam Martial Court that these deserters were still subject to German military law. So it begs the question of how these, you know, it speaks to the silence of this provision, right? Because it's, on the one hand, it affirms explicitly that the law of the detaining state applies, and it does not affirm, and in fact, it is accepted that the law of the home state also apply. How do they interact is a question that remains to be settled. Now, all these cases involve what we might describe as real law. And by real law, I mean law that everyone will accept as law in the fullest sense of the thing. These are state legal norms that will be defined as law. The picture of law and war becomes more muddled and complicated when we introduce non-legal orders into the fray, which happens quite regularly. So, not rarely, non-state armed groups in areas under their control will establish their own courts. As Veronica mentioned, I wrote this book, Rebel Courts, The Administration of Justice by Armed Insurgents, and I spent 5 years writing and researching about that. And one example of that is this somewhat gory still from a video in which Omar Sakan, who is the man to the complete left on the picture that you recognize from his mugshot later on, is about to execute the man on the ground. I haven't looked at the video, but it is out there. And he was afterwards a political refugee in Sweden, where he mentioned none of this, obviously. But the video resurfaced, and he was recognized in Sweden, and he was arrested and charged with murder. Because on the video, right, the whole execution happens, and fatefully, unlike some of the others at the other end, he does not cover his face to participate in this execution. And in his defense, before the Stockholm District Court, this was in 2017, Sakan recognized that it was him and that he did shoot and kill the man on the ground. But he explained that the men on the ground were soldiers of the Syrian regime that had been captured after a battle, and that they had been tried by a court of the Free Syrian Army, on which sat a number of judges who had defected from the official judiciary of Syria to join the Free Syrian Army, and who had applied the Syrian penal code. And the men were found to have committed murder and rape, and indeed to have documented some of their crimes on their own cell phones that had been found on them when they were captured. And the penalty for these crimes under the Syrian penal code was capital punishment. Sakan was not there the day of the trial. He was on assignment in another village. And when he came back, he was simply ordered to be part of a firing squad and told these men have been convicted by a court and have to be executed. And so he did. And so he argued that he was, just executing a sentence of a court and ought not to be held responsible. The Stockholm District Court concluded that the court could be validly constituted and could exercise jurisdiction and apply this law, but that because there was only 24 hours elapsing between the capture of these government soldiers and their execution, that the trial had been manifestly unfair. And so the problem was the fairness of the trial. The problem was not one of law, nor one of jurisdiction, but of how the trial played out. And for that reason, the court held Sakan guilty of murder, condemned him to life in prison, mandatory punishment for murder in the first degree in Sweden, and to this day he is in a high security prison in Sweden. So this is, it's interesting, and we might think, okay, it's understandable because in that context, the non-state armed group here, the Free Syrian Army, is in control of territory over parts of Syria. It is exercising public governance in that part of Syria. It is sort of the state in that part of Syria because the Syrian state is not there, right? This area was no longer in control. So it is, you know, just non-state justice in lieu of state justice when state justice isn't possible. It's not accessible. There were no Syrian state courts operating in that part of Syria at the time. And in any case, there was no justice to be found in the courts of the government of Syria in all cases. Now, that was so in that case, you know, if you want to read 500 pages about that, you could go look at the book that I read. And then there's all sorts of variations, you know, from the FARC to the Tamil Tigers that go in different directions and that are not quite the same as here. What we see is that this also can occur in situations where the state is there and the state is fully in control. So that non-state justice can happen despite the state as a challenge to state authority. And another fascinating example that, again, it's nearly nothing on this, and certainly not in law, are the establishment of courts in Jewish ghettos in territory occupied by Germany during World War II. And this happened in Lodz, Vilna, Warsaw, and other places. There's very little information about what happened in the ghettos for obvious reasons. And so the very fragmentary information available. Now, so the ghettos were established by German authorities to gather Jews in territory that they occupied. And so they concentrated the Jews in the concentration, these concentration camps, or initially in cities. And the Germans created for each of these ghettos a Judenrat, so a Jewish council, literally, so that essentially the Jews could administer themselves, that the Germans didn't have to do it, right? And so the Jews were in charge of distributing the food and education and healthcare, in as much as there was any of these things actually available in the ghetto. In some of the ghettos, this included a court. That was the court of the Judenrat in the ghetto. And so some of these courts were established with the knowledge and consent of German authorities. But even where such courts were created with the consent and knowledge of the German authorities, what I found is that they did stuff that they were allowed to do and then other things they weren't supposed to do, right? And so it was used as a way to sidestep German authority, even when it was a recognized court. And in other ghettos, the courts were established completely without the knowledge or consent of German authorities, so completely as a kind of ground-up, a community action to create law and order in the ghetto. And so one of the rare documents that we have access to that speaks to that is a diary by a man named Hermann Krück, who was in the Vilna ghetto for several years, and who wrote a diary. And this, so this is actually amazingly, this is a photo of a page of the manuscript or the original of the diary that was recovered at the end of the war in 1945. And This is an excerpt that you can see where he talks about Court. So for some time, Court has been functioning in our ghetto, carrying on its work by authorization of the Judenrat, so apparently official one. Of course, wherever there is a police with a criminal department, a local Jewish prison, a secret police, etc., there must also be a court. And of course, wherever there is a court, there must be a prosecutor, a judge, lawyer, secretary, the full show. Chief judge of the court is the Vilna attorney, Shrolovitz. The judges are Abrasha, Shrutniks, Notes, and Dole. On Tuesday, February 2nd, 1942, public trial was held, which had the genuine stamp of gangsterism. Chaim Heyman, Holtz, and Glazer were on trial. All three hired lawyers. Heyman was found guilty and sentenced to 6 months in prison and a 200 mark fine. Holtz and Glazer, 3 months in prison. The pretrial detention is included, and they have the right to appeal to the Judenrat. So, I don't know about you, but to me, this sounds like a pretty ordinary, like, description of a court, a day in court, despite the circumstances that were extraordinary. And obviously, Jewish ghettos often have an overabundance of lawyers. And so there was no shortage of, you know, qualified jurists to play a role in these institutions. And, you know, the Jewish population of territories occupied by the Germans was a population like any other population, with nice people and some less nice people. And so there were all sorts of antisocial behavior inside the ghettos of the kind that you find in every place and at every time. And so there was a need, indeed a demand, by the population of the ghetto for law and order. And so these courts handled everything from alimony to murder. And they sanctioned with everything from payments of, 5 kilos of potatoes to death by hanging. And capital punishment was imposed by some of these ghetto courts on Jewish inhabitants of the ghettos for serious crimes. Under what law? It's hazy. It seemed to not have been altogether clear, or at least reading the information we have, it seems not to have been completely clear. But it begs the question, you know, what was the law? Like, what law? Who has jurisdiction? What about these judges? I mean, is that lawful? Did they commit a crime? We know that after the war, capos from concentration camps were prosecuted, right? These were inmates that had authority position inside the camps. To my knowledge, no judge was ever prosecuted for presiding over, including, official murder of individuals. So it is complicated. We can make this complicated further, and the connection is to some extent to a different type of Jewish courts established in displaced persons camp after the end of the war. Displaced persons in Germany in 1945 were not Germans. Those were described as refugees. DPs were Jews or other kind of enemies of the Reich. And they were placed in camps for their protection, and they were camps created specifically for Jews within the Allied zones of control. And in the American zone, it was discovered that the Jews had created their own courts. Presumably, there probably were courts in the concentration camps, but I suppose there is. I have no evidence that there were. But if there were some in the ghettos and then some in the DP camps, it'd be surprising if there were none in the intermediate phase in the concentration or extermination camps. And here, so the camps were created to prosecute capos initially, who were discovered in the DP camps. To avoid, as this quote, this is from a report that I found, about this to avoid, you know, being lynched without a process. And from there, these courts acquired the general jurisdiction. And at some point, the Americans discovered this when the wife of a capo who was convicted complained to the Americans. And then the Americans woke up to the fact that these courts had been operating in the camps. And they tried to stop them. And they ordered that these courts stop operating, but they continued anyway, despite American opposition. So all of this, you know, is, and then there was another bit here of the same document. So all of this, you know, begs a lot of question as, you know, what is the law here and how do we decide if we try to figure out, you know, what is the legal answer to this question, what is the answer to be given? Now, jurisdiction is one of the devices that the law uses to settle those kinds of disputes, so to manage the multiplicity of laws, because there is always a lot of laws, right? There are always contradictory legal orders from different places, and so we're used to that. And so, who has jurisdiction is one way to deal with it. And there are rules about time, place, action, and actors that settle who has jurisdiction or primary jurisdiction. In international law, there are no jurisdictional monopolies, right? And so because of equal sovereignty of all states, it's very, you know, it's hard to reconcile that with any absolute claims of monopoly. So overlapping jurisdictions in international law is the rule. It's been described as a good thing, right? That's why you can have multiple prosecutions for the same event, right? Nabis in idem only applies for the same jurisdiction and the same crime, not different jurisdictions. Double taxation isn't a problem, right? In a different field. Private international law is another area, is another device to settle competing claims as to what is the applicable law. But private international law, conflict of laws, as the Americans say, is really about coordinating unilateral recognition of foreign laws by local courts, rather than really coordinating which law regulates. So both jurisdiction and private international law are inscribed in a statist understanding of law that is connected to a positivist understanding of law. And there's this interesting quote by the General Counsel of the U.S. Department of Defense about international law that clearly affirms that. So international law is made by state and is for states. And that certainly simplifies some of the stories that I've been talking about, but not not all of them. And my suggestion is that legal pluralism, as opposed to positivism, offers a richer understanding of law that allows us to speak more fully and deeply to the realities that I've been describing than positivism. Because, as I say, and I won't go through it because it's time for me to stop talking, you know, positivism is predicated on monism, centralism, positivism, and prescriptivism, as opposed to legal pluralism, whereby law is fragmented, so not necessarily coherent, decentralized, with many centers of creation and application, contingent. So legal norms, legal rules do not have a priori content, right? They acquire content in interaction with some kind of setting, such that what in American law school or common law school they describe as IRAC, issue, rule, application, conclusion, this legal abomination, as I tell my students, is doesn't make sense. And law is deliberative. So it's more of a way to talk to each other than kind of set of rules providing answers. So legal pluralism, you know, allows us to avoid a conclusion that positivism sort of mandates that these courts really are all vigilante courts or kangaroo courts or mob justice, which is the way they tend to be described by whoever's in charge of the government in the area that they relate to. So legal pluralism invites us to engage with a wider range of norms and practices as law. And that allows us to engage with, among other things, the fairness of the proceedings. Because if these are not courts nor is it law, then there's no way we could justify talking about the fairness of it, because that only relates to courts applying law. And so you need to be, I think, a pluralist in order to get there. It doesn't mean that everything becomes law, nor that law is reducible to power, to a claim of hierarchy, because power is never absolute. And for there, Jews in ghettos is there an image of a more disempowered individual than Jewish persons under Nazi authority in a ghetto? And yet, even they manage to have agency. Law is, you know, more than a set of rules to authorize or prohibit. And I leave you with these two quotes, one from Robert Cover in his wonderful article, Nomos and Narrative, who speaks of the capacity to law to imbue action with significance is not limited to resistance or disobedience. Law is a resource and signification that enables us to submit, rejoice, struggle, pervert, mock, disgrace, humiliate, or dignify. Or, with some hubris, citing myself, in Rebel Court, so law stands not only as a system of rules, but also as a register of meanings, a claim of identities, and a manifesto of aspirations. So my argument is that for us to be good lawyers, we have to tackle law in this much wider understanding, rather than narrow ourselves and say that other problems are politics or just, you know, ordinary life that law does not govern.